Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there. Welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation. And the purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of just defending positions. Well, here we are at the most politically contentious time in America since the Civil War. And can you imagine what it would take to reunite America? You can't? Well, our guest this week, Mark Gurzon, can. He's written a book called The Reunited States of America, which is going to be made into a documentary beginning of next year. And his life work for the past half century has been bringing all sides together in fruitful conversation. He's the president of the Mediators Foundation. He's one of the key architects in the field of global leadership and an experienced facilitator in high conflict zones. He's advised a wide variety of organizations, including the U.S. Congress, multinational corporations as well. He's the author of numerous books, including Leading Through Conflict and Global Citizens. As I said, his most recent book is The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. And he's been concerned about the increasing polarization in American communities, and he spent the last 20 years working on the ideological frontier between left and right, these two seemingly dueling realities. He's co-designed and served as head facilitator for the U.S. bipartisan congressional retreats in the late 1990s. We'll talk a little bit about that. And he spent the following years participating in a wide variety of efforts to deepen the dialogue across the political spectrum and divide. He's currently developing with his colleagues a multi-pronged strategy to build a transpartisan movement in the United States. Now, studies have shown that more than two-thirds of Americans would prefer to solve problems working together as opposed to sowing more divisiveness and discord. And here the question comes, can the majority of us work together to move forward the political agenda that the vast majority of us want, election integrity, anti-gerrymandering, money out of politics, working together to solve problems, instead of engaging in that lose-lose tug-of-war that's been helping destroy politics in this country. Well, that's what I'm going to talk with Mark about today. I'm very excited. Welcome, Mark.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Good. Well, as you can tell, we're addressing the most challenging paradox. We've never been more divided in our lifetime, and yet more than two-thirds of us are looking for a way to collaborate. Figure that out. Now, as somebody who's been involved in mediation for decades, and in fact, as we mentioned earlier, you worked with members of Congress in the 1990s at a retreat to bring them together in fruitful collaboration and conversation. Well, here we are. It's 25 years later. How did we go from civility to where we are right now?
Well, first question is, when was civility? And I think it's a relative term, Steve, but I can tell you In my lifetime, I've been involved in this work for approximately 25 years, maybe 30 if you add the work I did on the local community level. And I would say that America was a more civil place, at least for white people. America was a more civil place for white people before the end of the Cold War, because all of our hatred was directed against the Soviet Union. And at the end of the Cold War, I felt a shift. I experienced a shift. I was very active in ending the Cold War. And I thought, well, then there'll be more peace in the Soviet Union and more peace in the United States. And what happened was that Russians lost their enemy and we lost our enemy. And suddenly that enemy energy had to find a place to land, because that's part of human psychology. You know, until we wake up, we tend to project everything that's bad on someone else. And when you couldn't project it on the Soviet Union, we started projecting on each other. Now, we have tried, I understand, to, you know, project it on Muslims and tried to project it on ISIS and Islam and tried to project it on, you know, various terrorist groups. But the bottom line is, you know, we are now kind of demonizing each other. And I think that was, that's when it started. It was probably about 25, 30 years ago. The end of the Cold War was 30 years ago. And since then, it's gotten incredibly worse. And I think the analogy that I use is you know, the oil light going on the dashboard of your car saying add oil. Well, that went on in the 90s, that oil light went on, and we never added oil, which is, you know, trust and collaboration and respect for each other and a willingness to work together. So that's why the engine's breaking down.
Well, you know, you were looking at this in the mid-90s. That was after the Berlin Wall fell, and before they tried to unite us around the so-called war on terror. Let's say circa mid-90s, we began to see the incivility, let's say, of the contract, I like to call it contract on America, I think it was contract for America, that Newt Gingrich put out. And I think that was, well, of course, not counting, what's his name? The guy before Karl Rove who died of the brain tumor, the Republican...
Lee Atwater.
Mm-hmm. Lee Atwater kind of started this in the 1980 campaign. But what was it that happened in the mid-90s that essentially weaponized politics?
Well, it did. It began in the mid-90s, and it became a very scientific pursuit that that Newt Gingrich helped lead. But the structural thing, before we blame a Republican or blame a Democrat, let's just say that most people do not know that the House of Representatives was controlled by the Democrats for 40 years, mm-hmm. from the end of World War II till the mid-90s. The Democrats controlled Congress. And guess who didn't like that? You know,
yeah.
The Republicans. they felt like they had been permanently shut out of the House of Representatives because there was a Democratic majority. And so in 1994, when they got in the majority, they said, okay. And that was Newt Gingrich's challenge. And he said, you know, we've got to bring real democracy to this country, and we won't have real democracy until we dislodge the Democrats. So they did what revolutionaries do. They picked a revolutionary strategy. And the revolutionary strategy was paint the Democrats as evil. Stop being civil. Stop being kind. Stop being collegial. Stop being respectful. And focus on them as really evil people. And, you know, while I don't like their tactics, Steve, I understand why they did it. They were trying to break, you know, the Democratic hold. So I would say 1994 was a turning point. And it was immediately after that that I ended up working with Congress, because they were all in shock. I mean, they were in shock in the late 90s, like, oh, my God, you know, we actually have to get along here. It's not a one party show anymore. We actually have to get along. What are we going to do? How do we do that? You know?
Well, yeah, and so you led a retreat with members of Congress, and a little bit about what happened at that retreat and how you sought to open up lines of communication and collaboration and respectful conversation.
Well, it was a powerful event that involved more than half the members of Congress and their spouses. So we had over 400 people. It was the largest peacetime movement of Congress in history.
Wow.
And it was a very powerful event that got a lot of news coverage because it was historic. It had never happened before. And everybody wondered, how are they going to get along? And since I was in charge of facilitating the process, you know, well in advance of the retreats, I said, well, we're only going to be different. We're only going to behave differently if the rules are different. I mean, anybody who follows sports who's listening to the show knows that, you know, you can have different rules for a game. Maybe you can have touch football or you can have tackle football. You know, you can have, you know, sort of civilized boxing with gloves, or you can have, you know, kind of the more wild and crazy cage matches, you know. And what are the rules? And so we developed some rules for the retreat that were very powerful. And, you know, most people won't find them startling. They were just things like respect, openness to different points of view, listening, and equal time. No, not equal time based on whether you're the majority or the minority party. It was just equal time because you're a human being, you know. And so these basic ground rules led to a retreat in which they really worked together. And, you know, it was a very powerful healing time at the retreat. But what the Congress didn't do was when they went back to Washington on that following Monday, they didn't take the ground rules back with them. They left the ground rules back at the retreat site in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And when they went back to Capitol Hill, they went back to the same old rules as before. That was the problem.
Yeah, I guess there were no more Hershey kisses once they got back to D.C.
There weren't.
No more kisses. And you know, that's really a problem. I've worked with Joseph McCormick, who also has done a lot of transpartisan work, and he said that the biggest challenge, even in bringing together leaders, is that when they go back to their constituencies and their tribes, the tribes are saying, well, what are you doing consorting with those people? Knock it off, and then you're back to back to the silos. So let's fast forward or slow forward 25 years to where we've seen the rift that was growing has become a chasm to the point where the two tribes are almost equally divided in this country. The two tribes are living in completely separate realities. How did that, you know, I understand the failure to pursue this the civil communication 25 years ago and develop pathways, but what are some of the trends that have contributed to where we are right now?
Well, we were seeing it back 25 years ago, but it was nothing compared to what it is today. That today you can literally create your own bubble. You can create your own bubble and your news bubble, and you can live inside your news bubble. I mean, when I grew up, just to take a simple contrast, when I grew up, you had the choice between ABC, NBC, and CBS, and they were all playing kind of by the same rules if you watched the evening news. They were very similar, although Walter Cronkite's the most famous of them. Well, today, you don't have to do that. Today, you can go to your network that's or your social media or your websites or your Instagrams or whatever. You can go to the ones that you are attracted to, your Facebook page. You can surround yourself with information that will reinforce, if you're a Trump voter, that Trump is, as one of the people who worked for him said, was the bodyguard of Western civilization, said one of his people. You know, so who's a tremendous, you can go to an area where Trump is an absolute hero fighting against the deep state. You can also go to a website where, you know, Trump is the devil and a world. You can create a bubble around you where Trump is evil and Joe Biden is a savior. You can also go to other places where Joe Biden is a moderate, you know, wishy-washy guy and Bernie Sanders is your savior. And the ability now to create a reality around us that reinforces us, the founding fathers never imagined that. They never imagined that once. They pictured people going to town meetings and city halls, and they pictured people reading maybe a town newspaper or reading a flyer. They could never have imagined that people would live in bubbles totally separate from each other.
Well, you know, what's also happened is that the fairness doctrine disappeared, and what used to be called the press is now the media. And so at some point, news switched to entertainment. You know, next year, 2021, is going to be the 40th anniversary since Walter Cronkite delivered his last "And That's the Way It Was." So it seems to me that one of the things that's missing is that there's no more neutral convener. There's no neutral space that most people in this country can relate to or activate. So, in other words, perhaps there are spaces like you and the Bridge Alliance and other organizations have been looking to create where people are brought together. But for the mainstream conversation, where is it that this point of view is? I'm not only asking it rhetorically; I'm asking it. Maybe you have an answer. Where is it that this conversation, this civil conversation, where respect matters, where facts matter, where is that conversation being held now?
Well, you've pinpointed the real problem in a society that gets divided. I worked for the United Nations in countries that had been at war and had violence. And you've pinpointed very accurately, Steve, the problem that they lose what they call convening institutions or neutral institutions, or what you can also call trusted institutions. Mm-hmm. That when trust erodes, you can't go to the church because you don't trust the church. You can't go to the media for an interview or for a debate because you don't trust the media. You can't go to the university because you think the university is left-wing or too liberal. You can't go anywhere. You can't go anywhere because trust has declined. And I think that's what I meant by oil. That's what I saw happening in the 90s. That was America's GNP going up? Yeah. Our GNP was skyrocketing. Was our military power skyrocketing? Yes. Was our tech skyrocketing? Yes. All these things were going up. Were the stock market going up? Yes. But what was happening to trust? Well, trust was going down. Trust was going down, but trust, Steve, you can measure GNP, and you can measure the stock market's prices, and you can measure a lot of things. You can measure the percentage of people with a college degree. You can measure the, median income. But how do you measure trust? And I think what's been happening, Steve, is that we've gained a lot in this country in lots of different levels. We've made a lot of, quote, progress, unquote. But a lot of that progress is made at the expense of trust. And that's what we're needing to do now. We're needing to build that trust back. And for me, the reason I use the oil metaphor is that almost everybody understands that their car needs to be taken care of. And people understand that if for 25 years you don't put oil in your car, you're going to end up with a dead engine, and that's basically where we are.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Mark Gerzon talking more about the reunited states of America and making this great shift at a time when we really need it. Steve Behrman, we're on WikiPolitiki.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America, 200 food banks strong.
Hi there, this is Steve Behrman. We're back on WikiPolitiki. We have our guest, Mark Gerzon. We're talking about the reunited states of America. Before we go talk about our current situation, I'm always curious as to how people find their work and their calling. How was it that you got involved with this kind of work, with mediation and ultimately with bringing together these seemingly intractable sides?
Well, how far back you want to go, Steve? You can go back to my parents' divorce, which made me look at the roots of conflict as a child. You can go back to the Vietnam War, which made me see the country being divided. You can go back to, my earliest training as a family mediator, as a family therapist, where I saw how endemic conflict was. So there are many roots, but I think for me, the fundamental turning point was in the early 90s when I started working in communities, local communities, just like the places where, your listeners now are sitting, places like, the Portland, Oregon or San Antonio or Chicago or And I noticed that these communities, you know, which you'd think would be working in their own best interest because they care about, you know, Phoenix, or they care about, you know, Tallahassee, and they want their city to work well, there was this growing divide happening. And I started looking at the divide, and by working in different communities, I realized that there was a pattern to the divide. And that although maybe people were neighbors, and maybe they were even white neighbors, and maybe they were even white Christian neighbors, they were starting to divide against each other around some basic issues and turn each other, you know, like basically suspicions were replacing trust. Hmm. So that was, I think, a turning point. And I then wrote this book called A House Divided, Six Belief Systems Struggling for America's Soul, which was the first time I really tackled this issue. And that's what led to my work with Congress. And then I realized that Congress was just as divided, you know, if not more divided than the communities that they represented. You know, if a Republican from Mississippi is sitting with a Democrat from Boston, and they're both in the House of Representatives, we think of them as, you know, members of the same House of Representatives. They come from completely different worlds. You know, the Democrat from Massachusetts might have 80% Democrats in his district, and the Republican from Mississippi might have 80 or 90% Republicans in their district. They come from completely different worlds. And yet there they are sitting next to each other. They're supposed to work together. In the old days, they would move to Washington and they would actually hang out together in nights, having a beer or whatever. But in this current age of jet planes and so forth, people would always go home on the weekend. So they didn't even take time to become friends. And the notion that they're supposed to work together magically, you know, that they're supposed to be oil in the engine of the House of Representatives, there's no magical oil. You know, nobody's inserting trust. The trust has to be built. You know, the same way that you build, you know, a brick, you know, if you're building a building, you'd build it with bricks and you do it carefully with mortar. Trust requires work, and we're not putting the trust in. We're really not putting the work in to build trust these days.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Back in the early 60s, late Eisenhower era, early Kennedy era, the American people, I think their trust in government and institutions of society was somewhere up around 80%. That's where it really peaked. And now we're, last I looked, it was under 20% and maybe growing closer to 10%. So the various things that have happened over the last 60 years, you know, probably including the assassinations, the war in Vietnam, the various areas of cultural conflict that we've had, have created this gap. And of course, there's the system, electoral system, is dependent on two forces. First, there are the vested interests that donate all the money to finance the campaigns. And then secondly, the true believer voters who provide the energy on the ground as the voting blocks who put the candidates over the top. So these two forces kind of leave the people out in the middle. So I want to talk about your work going on right now that led to the Reunited States of America, and what it is that you see in this, you know, very dire situation, what it is that you see that can be done to shift this to more trust.
Well, Steve, that's the good news. The good news is that there has built over these 25 years. I mean, I'm not alone in noticing this. Many of your listeners right now have said, well, I've been watching the same thing happen. And there were a lot of Americans watching this, and a lot of them have started projects of various kinds to heal the divide. They've been actually saying, hey, we have a way of putting oil in the engine of democracy. You know, come and look at our project, which is called Living Room Conversations, or come and look at our project, which is called AllSides.com, or come and look at our project. And people have started. That's one of the wonderful thing about America is people see a problem, they start to fix it. And both Republicans, Democrats have started these projects. And we started back in 2014. We realized that there was a movement. So we started an organization called the Bridge Alliance, and you can go to it, bridgealliance.us. And we started an organization that's now a network of over 100 organizations of all different stripes all across the country building bridges in different ways. So there's a movement, and I wrote the book, The Reunited States of America, about that movement and about those people. And the film that's now being made by an LA team is a documentary basically saying, let's showcase some of these people. Who are they? How is that former Republican political operative? What did he do to make things better? You know, what did the mother of Heather Heyer, who was killed in Charlottesville, what did she do after her daughter was killed by Nazis? You know, what did Greg Orman, who ran as an independent in Kansas, why did he run as independent? And what did he learn from running as an independent? And why is that so important? And Stephen Olakara, you know, who started the Millennial Action Project, you know, he's united, you know, Democrats and Republicans who are under 40 all across the country. there's hundreds of people like that, Steve, and that's the good news, is that people are saying, hey, there's a problem here in America. Let's fix it together. Let's fix it together, and let's not pretend it's not there anymore. So that's absolutely the good news.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing is that until now, all of this has been under the radar. I've been watching it because I've been paying attention to it, and I've been, you know, trying to spark this this transpartisan awakening, not to kind of slough over differences, but to essentially deal with conflict in a helpful way. However, none of this stuff is on the radar. It's very rare that you see something. There are no blaring headlines, you know, people from across the party lines cooperate, you know, details at 11. You never hear that. It's basically all about the conflict and all about firing people up. You've probably seen the documentary, The Social Dilemma, which really talks that I'm assuming you have, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so for the people out there in Radio Land, which I highly recommend this documentary, it really talks about how our minds are manipulated subconsciously, largely, to reinforce what we already believe and to continue to buy into narratives that stimulate us emotionally so that we'll stick on the website so that their advertisers can, you know, so that they can get greater revenues from their advertisers. And, you know, you didn't have that kind of intensified operation working against you in the 1990s. So how does that, given the amount of energy that the media spends on talking about bringing people together, as opposed to stoking these very divisive narratives, how do you deal with this, that imbalance?
Well, it's a challenge, Steve, and I know you've studied it closely. Have you thought about the answer yourself to that? Have you wondered, have you come up with an idea of your own before I share mine?
Well, I think we're probably very similar. I think first of all, the first step is to rehumanize the other that has been dehumanized mm-hmm. by these narratives. And then the second thing is to do, like you mentioned, Living Room Conversations, Braver Angels. These organizations are bringing people together to talk face-to-face where they can't lob insults over a wall, and they have to recognize that they're talking to another human being, and that mitigates some of the edge. I also think that there needs to be institutions where people can gather together and actually help design policy from across the political divide so that we use the energies of conservative and progressive in a functional rather than dysfunctional way.
Well, I agree with you, and I'll put in a plug for my favorite organization in this particular regard, which is, you know, the internet has divided us. And yeah. And I met, you know, 8 years ago, I met John Gable, who was out of that world of the internet. He had worked right. for Mozilla and Facebook and other Silicon Valley companies. He's a Republican. Yeah. And he said he watched the internet turn into something that he hadn't intended. He thought the internet was going to unite us, and instead the internet was dividing us.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, this is a problem. He said, how are we going to fix this? Well, because he's an internet genius, he thought, well, I'll start a platform. And he calls it allsides.com.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, if the internet's going to divide us, maybe the internet can also unite us. So if you go to allsides.com, you'll see the news every day from the left, the right, and the center. And he's basically saying, you know, okay, we can look at things in different ways. Let's start to bring all those different ways into the same website. Let's become familiar with those different ways. And let's teach our kids how to become a more savvy, discerning, thoughtful, creative citizen in dealing with those different points of view. So what I love about that story is that it shows that, you know, the poison produces its own antitoxin. You know, in a free society, if we create a problem, we are also free to create the solution to that problem. And I think allsides.com is in a wonderful, small, and modest way trying to do that. You know, and I think everybody who's profiled in the United States and in the film and the book, everybody's doing that in their own way. They're saying, I see a problem. I'm going to go out and create something to fix it. And I invite listeners to your show to you know, to say what's the problem that most irritates me? What's the problem that most bothers me? You know, is it what's happening at the border? Is it what's happening in my own community? Is it the way, you know, minorities are being treated? Is it the way schools are becoming, you know, more hostile places? Is it, you know, what is it that's bothering? Is it hunger? Is it the way we're responding to COVID? And then ask yourself, well, if I'm free to see the problem, I'm also free to be part of the solution. What could I do? And that's what everybody in the Bridge Alliance has done. They basically said, I'm going to start an initiative. And, you know, if you can join one that already exists, it's a lot less work. But I really feel that's our calling. That's what the founding fathers and mothers really want us to do, you know. So.
You know, what you're talking about, really, it's a very ecological approach, which is diversity, diverse approaches. There's not just one solution. I really appreciate what John has done through all sites on our mobilize.news website that we're launching. All sites is featured. He's also involved with Joan Blades in Living Room Conversations. And, you know, that's another way of rehumanizing the other. I've participated in those, and it really makes a difference. In looking at so obviously we have what my friend Richard Lang calls an ecology, an ecosystem of civic engagement. There is this ecosystem that is developing, and there's many, many different projects that, you know, some will succeed and some won't. And so these single cell organisms are working in their own little domain. What I'm curious about is, what can you see that's going to cohere this movement over this very dangerous, we're in a very dangerous time. You know, and I don't like exaggeration, but certainly the two sides are so disconnected from one another in different realities. Fear has been, you know, that fear has been used to stoke the flames. How can a movement like this actually come together to create what I would be calling a sane and sacred center?
Yeah, that's a beautiful phrase. Well, I think for me, I'm another analogy, if I can, that, you know, it used to be back in the day, if you wanted a taxi, you called something called the Yellow Cab Company. And you call them on your phone, and, you know, you might have them in your community, you might not, and eventually this yellow cab might roll up and pick you up. But it was basically, if you needed a ride. Well, today a lot of people don't even know what yellow cab is. You know, they would call Uber or Lyft, and it's like there was a new player in town, Uber and Lyft. You know, it was like a new way of getting a ride. Well, I think right now a lot of people think, well, if I want to be politically active, I have to be a Democrat or Republican. Otherwise, you know, I can't play. And there are two narratives. And what we're basically saying is, no, there's been an invention since then. It's not called Uber. It's not called Lyft. It's called the transpartisan movement, you know. And there's a whole set of ways, you know, that you can get involved, not as a Democrat, not as a Republican, although you're welcome to be conservative or liberal. I don't begrudge anybody their political opinions. But you can also see that we need a third narrative, you know, which is, how do we cross the divide? And we need Democrats who want to cross the divide, and we need Republicans who can want to cross the divide. That was my main teaching from my work with Congress, Steve, was that we are always going to have Democrats and Republicans in the House, and they'll always be, I think, more or less evenly divided. You know, they might tip one way at one time or one way or the other. But what's key in the House of Representatives is that there has to be some Democrats and some Republicans who say, well, let's work out this stimulus package, otherwise Americans won't have food and businesses will stay shut. You know, well, let's work out an immigration policy. Well, let's work out a foreign policy. Well, let's work out health care. Because if we don't work out health care, Americans, you know, won't have the support they need when they get sick. So there has to be people who are willing to collaborate. And that's actually a third narrative. And I'm trying to elevate that third narrative. And this program that you're doing today is part of elevating this narrative to say, you don't have just two choices, right and left. You also have a third choice, which is, I'm going to bridge the divide. And that's, I think, what we need to do is we need to make, just like people know they can call Uber or Lyft, they can now call and get involved with the transpartisan movement or the bridge building movement or whatever you want to call it. I don't feel strongly about the term. What I feel strongly about is the purpose, which is, you know, remembering that we're the United States of America, not the divided states.
Obviously, this documentary coming out based on your book is designed to make people more aware that there is this movement going on. I know that people are longing for something like that, but in the noise and in the noise of social media, you know, it's not a glamorous thing. It's just like it's getting down to the nuts and bolts. And I've been involved in, you and I were at the Transpartisan Citizens Summit in Denver in 2011, and I've been involved with other things, and it gets messy. It's human beings, you know, and people bring their agendas, they bring their resentments. I think, as you said earlier, there's a lot of connection between where we are individually, our emotional maturity as individuals, and how easily that could be thrown off in moments of crisis like we're in right now, where there's more stress, people are feeling more defended. They may have less bandwidth for the kinds of things that we're doing collaborating. So obviously this film that you're putting out is designed to awaken and educate people, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for people who want to know more about it, they can go to reunitedstates.tv and they can, you know, they can track its progress and when it's, how it's going to be released next year and why it was made and see a trailer and get to know it. reunitedstates.tv. I really recommend it. I didn't make the film, but I participated in it, and I was very impressed with what they've done. A young group of filmmakers who said, hey, if we're going to have a future as young Americans, we need to make sure this country hangs together. Otherwise, we're going to pay the price. Because, you know, what I'd say to any young listeners you have today, Steve, is that, in my view, the Democrats want to spend the next generation's money one way, and the Republicans want to spend the next generation's money another way. And these older politicians are arguing about how to spend the next generation's money. And if I were the next generation, I would say, hey, that's our money. Stop spending our money. Stop mortgaging our future. When we're 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, we'd like to be able to make some decisions ourselves. You're in the process of putting us so far in debt. I mean, student debt is just the tip of the iceberg. We're putting the country in debt for future generations. So they're going to be inheriting it. And that's something the Democrats and Republicans seem to be both willing to do. So we really need a millennial rebellion, a millennial transpartisan rebellion that says, no, we're not going to let you do that to us.
Good. Well, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back with the final segment with Mark Gerson talking about the reunited states of America and how we get from where we are now to where we need to be. We'll be back shortly.
Free your mind with OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, we're back with our guest, Mark Gerson. We're talking about how to reunite the United States. There's some heartening news that I think people are waking up to what the problem is. And hopefully this movie and some other things will help people gravitate toward the solutions and different choices. I want to get a little bit granular here. This really has to do with how does one bring people together? Once you get people in a room, like the Living Room Conversations, like Braver Angels, like the work that you did with the members of Congress, how did you establish a new set of ground rules, and what were those ground rules?
Well, that's a great question, and what it requires is obviously what I call an empowered third side. You know, you said earlier quite wisely, Steve, that, you know, if you don't trust, if there's no trusted convener, and guess who convened the members of the House of Representatives? The only people they would trust was themselves. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that, you know, a Democrat turned to another Republican on the House floor and said, hey, this isn't why I came to Congress. This is horrible. I mean, we're not getting anything done. And his Republican colleague said, yeah, this is, you know, David, this is really a mess. What are we going to do about it? And they said, well, let's talk to so-and-so and so-and-so. So they went to another Democrat and Republican, and the four of them had lunch. And then the four of them said, well, the four of us alone can't do anything, but why don't we ask so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so? So they asked four more. And then the eight of them wrote a letter to the entire Congress and said, hey, you know, we're falling apart as an institution. We're not getting the job done. We're not enjoying our work. This is not civility. This is not problem solving. This is not why we came to Washington. Let's have a retreat. So, you know, they did exactly what an ordinary citizen needs to do, Steve, which is to say, I can't wait. I mean, they didn't wait for the party leaders. If they had waited for the party leaders, nothing would have happened, because the party leaders are very happy being party leaders because they've got a lot of power. And suddenly there were these Democrats and Republicans saying, let's work together. So that's the first step, is to organize it from the inside. And then once they contacted me and asked me to work with them, I said, well, let's develop some ground rules. And, you know, we brought 12 Democrats and 12 Republicans together. And we said, well, what are the ground rules that would make this a safe space? And the first ground rule they came up with was respect. You know, let's agree that we're going to respect each other and not challenge each other's integrity or motives or purpose. That, you know, let's give each other the basic respect we deserve, because we're elected members of Congress and we're representing our districts, and we're decent people. So let's respect each other. And then there was an agreement to have openness was the second ground rule, openness to different points of view. And part of that led to the third ground rule, which is listening. You know, let's agree to listen to each other, not, you know, rehearsing our responses, but actually listening to each other. So respect, openness, and listening was kind of, you know, first three ground rules. And then I brought up the fact that, you know, you're not going to respect each other and you're not going to listen if you don't feel like you're going to get a fair shake to speak yourself. So I said, we better have a ground rule called fairness, you know, that you don't get a lot of time and someone else gets no time. No, there's an allotted amount of time for a certain number of people, you know, you should distribute it fairly. So fairness was another ground rule. And then there was a, you know, they wanted a ground rule of confidentiality, that they didn't want people running out to the press when somebody was speaking from their heart in an open and vulnerable way. They didn't want somebody running out to the press and say, guess what so-and-so said at our retreat. So they had a ground rule of confidentiality. And their last ground rule was commitment, that they said, we're committed to staying here. We're committed not to going off on our cell phones. We're not going to disappear. We're not going to go have a drink in the middle of a meeting. If we say we're going to be here, we're going to be here, which is very important in Congress because, as you know, people are always leaving to go do something else, you know, and leaving the floor or leaving their office because they've got to be somewhere else. And so you never know when a congressperson is going to be there or when they're going to be gone the next moment. So those may sound like very basic, you know, kind of almost, you know, middle school kind of ground rules. But that's what we have learned as a people, you know, that we need those ground rules. And I'm sure, you know, your listeners are thinking, well, that's what my wife and I do, or my husband and I do. You know, I mean, we've got some ground rules, too, because otherwise we don't get along. And to me, the question then, which came up in the presidential debates, was who's going to enforce these ground rules? Now, at the retreat, those 24 members that we trained, we said, you guys are responsible. You guys, you women, are responsible for enforcing these ground rules in the rooms that you're facilitating. But in ordinary life, you know, who enforces the ground rules? And what we saw with the presidential debates, particularly in the first one, Steve, was that, you know, the moderator who basically got trampled over, you know. You know, it was just like the moderator just was like trampled over by Donald Trump, who wouldn't stop talking and kept interrupting. And, you know, and the moderator had really no recourse. He couldn't turn off the mic. He couldn't say you're breaking a ground rule. And when he did it, you know, Trump just kept talking. So that's why ground rules are essential. And I, you know, I just was watching an NFL game the other day. And, you know, I was noticing once again that, you know, there's passion on both sides for their teams. But everybody kind of trusts the refs. Everybody recognizes that the rules are being called honestly. There's, you know, instant replay if you want to see it again. And people recognize that there's trustworthy refs, trustworthy rules, that the, you know, the scrimmage lines are clear. And when somebody scores, you know, it goes up. Whereas we have an election like the one we just had, which we haven't discussed yet, really. But if we could take the same sense of sportsmanship to our elections that we take to our football and basketball games, Steve, we'd have a great country. But we somehow haven't done that. You know, we have better enforcement and more trusted refs at games that really don't matter. And at the games that really do matter, which we call elections, we are now the rules and the refs are falling apart.
Well, in this recent election, and certainly for the past number of years since Donald Trump has been on the political radar here, he has actually made his own rules. And apparently the people who voted for him, even if they do recognize his personality defects, I'm putting that mildly, nonetheless, they've gone along with his flouting of the rules. How is that seems to be a much more extreme example of what we're talking about. What insights do you have about that?
Well, that's a tough one. I think this is why so many people are lamenting that other Republicans are not saying to their president, you've lost, sir, you know, you've lost. And let's stop this charade and just accept that you've lost. And I mean, I know the arguments, you know, the arguments are he's entitled to make sure that their votes were counted honestly, et cetera. That's fine. But he should say, let's finish the vote counting. And if it remains in this way, I will concede. Instead, you know, it's a basic flouting of the rules. And when a player does that in a sports game, we would immediately look at their teammates. You know, if let's say somebody does a really flagrant foul in a basketball game. Do their teammates defend the one who did the flagrant foul because he's their teammate? Or do they recognize, hey, that was a flagrant foul. You deserve to be, you know, kicked out of the game or whatever the, you know, ref's penalty is. So this is where we are. This is why I said trust. That if we still had the basic trust that we need in this country, other Republicans would be now saying, Mr. President, you've lost. It's time to concede. You no longer have my support. Challenging this peaceful and fair and prompt transition that we've had in our country's history. So that's why the ground rules are so essential. And we're learning that we need to strengthen our ground rules, because if one irresponsible politician who doesn't follow the rules can cause such havoc, it shows that we need a revitalization. We need a revitalization of our ground rules, a serious revitalization.
Well, that brings us to another good question. You know, who's going to put the bill on the cat? How are those of us who do want to create a sane and sacred center where the rules apply evenly, even-handedly, how can that be created when there isn't any neutral convener, any trusted convener? We've come to the level of lack of trust to the point where there just doesn't seem to be anybody. And so what we're, you know, right now we're in the midst of a crisis that may or may not be resolved by Inauguration Day. We'd like to believe that it is, but the indicators are that, I'm on all kinds of mailing lists, and the people who are, you know, reading Breitbart and all of that stuff, they're expecting that the votes are all going to be overturned and that Trump is going to win. There's a certainty about that,
right?
That narrative on that on that side, and I'm sure there. My sense is their reality check is going to bounce. As my sense, mm-hmm. However, because of how deeply held that belief is, and likely based on misinformation, there's the chance of people taking up arms to protect and defend this current administration. In the short run, how can the sane and sacred forces in this country, how can that be asserted to the point where it does awaken whatever conscience those on the Republican side have?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, You know, my feeling is this is a time to talk about different levels, Steve, because at the local level, I think everybody listening to this program has power. Because in your local community, certainly in your neighborhood, you get together with somebody on the other other side politically, and the two of you or the four of you, just like the members of Congress, can do a lot in your own neighborhood or your own community. So at that level, I think we can all feel a sense of agency. And I think we can all become trusted conveners. We can all create trusted conveners. And my book, The United States, talks about how to do that. When you get to the state and national level, of course, it's harder for an ordinary person to deal with the absence of a trusted convener. It's much more difficult at the state and national level because most of us don't have that kind of political power. Even there, what I think we can do is I think we can prevail upon our representatives. For example, I live in Colorado. I have a Democratic congressman who represents my district. There's a Republican in the next district next door. Well, I have done an event with both of those members of Congress. I said, I want to help you host events in your districts and work with you to host events that you could work together on. And we did that after Trump's inauguration, where they hosted an event together. And it was very powerful to see these two Congress people, one a Democrat who represented my district, one the Republican from next door. I was the facilitator. And that just took two members of Congress. And one could ask one's own congressperson, whether you live in a red district or a blue district, you know, please, would you please partner with somebody else in our state delegation who's from the other party? And could the two of you start to, you know, look out for our community, look out for our state? When I work in states, Steve, I often will say to people, you know, where's your Michigan patriotism? You know, where's your Minnesota patriotism? Mm-hmm. why are you letting these Washington politicians come in and divide you against your neighbors? Divide you against the other people in your church, for God's sake, you know, divide you against other parents of children in your school district. Don't let them divide you. Be proud Michiganders or proud Minnesotans and stand up for yourself, you know, and stand up for your state. And I really want to think, I think what's essential is that everybody needs to ask themselves, the principle of community organizing is start with who you are and what you have. And, you know, whoever you are, you have a certain amount of power, you know, whether you're if you're a mom in a PTA, you know, or you're a dad coaching a soccer team or, you know, whatever you've got some power to build bridges when they need to be built. And I think that's the key, is don't let this system disempower us, because the whole purpose of being free in this country that we call the land of the free and the home of the brave is to use that freedom, you know, and the idea of being boxed into a red box or a blue box doesn't feel like freedom to me.
You know, what you're doing is you're waking people from a trance. There's the trance of how things are and how things are expected to be. And again, I'm on all political lists on both parties, so I get these alarming messages. Send us $3 to defeat the bad guy, whichever bad guy you're defeating. And so much of what the political parties are doing are they're stoking the fire of separation. And what you're doing is what you said about church members is very important, because family members have been are not talking to one another because of this. And this is a serious thing. In the few minutes that we have left, what is it that you're seeing, even though things are pretty dicey right now, what is it that you find the most promising and encouraging for this new order to emerge?
Well, I think what's most promising is that 25 years ago, when I said things are getting worse, we really are divided against each other, many people said, oh no, Mark, that's just politics. Don't worry about it. You're just making too big a deal out of it. It's just politics. Mm-hmm. It's fine. It'll work out fine. And I would say, no, the red light's on the dashboard here. You know, we've got to add oil. Like, no. That there's always been moments like that in American history. Don't become an alarmist. It's really going to work out fine. Well, Steve, that doesn't happen anymore. I don't go to anywhere where people say, oh no, this is just like it's always been. It's not getting worse. So I feel like now that Americans recognize the engine needs oil, more people are saying, hey, you know, I'm going to buy a can of oil and open the hood and start to put it in my own way. And I think that's my greatest hope, is that more and more Americans wake up and that we get more transpartisan Republicans and more transpartisan Democrats who say, I still think I'm right, but I'm not going to accomplish what I want to accomplish unless I work with that other side, you know. And well, damn it, I'm going to work with them. You know, I'm going to learn how to work with them, because it looks like if I really care, I'll close with this example. If you want your kids to be safer at school tomorrow, then don't be a hardcore left winger. Don't be a hardcore right winger. Get together with other parents in your school district and say, hey, we want our schools to be safer tomorrow, safer from COVID, safer from mass shootings, safer from everything. How can we make our schools safer? Let's work together because we love our kids. And that's the key, is do you love your kids more, or do you love more being right?
Well, I think that's really the fundamental, is that that in times of stress, people devolve into wanting to be right. And what you're doing and what a number of these other transpartisan agencies are doing are awakening people from that trance of separation and saying, if you want things to happen, if you want things to get done, if you want to live in the real world, then that requires actually collaborating to solve problems rather than simply defending positions. Mark Gerson, it's been a pleasure having you on WikiPolitiki. The book is called The Reunited States of America. The movie will be coming out next year, and I will post the movie link on my website, so when people listen to the replay, they can hear it. Thank you so much for being with us, Mark Gerson.
Thank you.